I'll now ask Father Brian to continue your study on Isaiah to the theme, Zion's Glad Morning.
In that hymn that we had tonight, my dear brothers and sisters, I thought there was a very beautiful section in the middle of that hymn. Verse 2, "Then the north in darkness shrouded, Jacob's rising star shall bless. Jacob's rising star shall bless. And the eastern morn, unclouded, bring the sun of righteousness, cheering, healing, with the brightness of his face." Oh, beautiful words. That's a very delightful hymn. And I thought tonight that was a good way to open our class after a cold, pretty dank night out there, isn't it? It's the pitch of winter. But it's good to come and to stir our hearts with such exultant thoughts as those. And it's a very lovely epitome, really, of this, well, Brother Daniel rightly said, one of the most beautiful chapters in the Bible, and surely one of the most inspirational chapters in the Bible. Just to give you a little bit of a break up first, verses 1 to 5, I've entitled Yahweh, the Light of Zion. Perhaps we won't go right down the chapter giving the breakup. We'll give it as we come. But that's our first little section. Verses 1 to 5. Yahweh, the Light of Zion. And the chapter opens up with this expression. It's a signal expression. You can see why the chapter has begun here. Arise, shine. For thy light is come, and the glory of Yahweh is risen upon thee. Now, who's speaking? And who is being spoken to? Well, it's fairly obvious, really, from the flow of thought, that it's God speaking. Look at verse 21. As for me, this is my covenant with them, saith Yahweh, my spirit. So that's the previous verse. So God is the speaker. Then to whom does he speak? Thy light is come. The glory of Yahweh is risen upon thee. Thy light, verse 23, thy light. Thine eyes, verse 4. Well, verse 5 makes it fairly clear, doesn't it? Then thou shalt see and flow together, and thine heart shall fear and be enlarged. Because the abundance of the sea shall be converted unto thee, the forces of Gentiles shall come unto thee. This is a woman with sons and daughters, verse 4. It's obviously speaking of Zion as though she were a mother. So the chapter is set with that sort of overtone of metaphor in which God is speaking to a city, to an impersonal city. Well, it's a city that's personified in this way. It's a very beautiful way. Like as though he could speak to that city with all the affection that he could speak, as a man might speak to his wife. With all the thoughts of affection and of her goodness and of her abundance. So Yahweh, the living God, can speak to Zion in that way. It's a beautiful chapter, isn't it? What a concept. Verse 14 makes it more than plain, doesn't it? Verse 14, the sons also of them that afflicted thee shall come bending unto thee. And all they that despise thee shall bow down themselves at the sole of thy foot. And they shall call thee the city of Yahweh, the Zion of the Holy One of Israel. Just to read those words in the light of present day politics is beautiful, isn't it? Refreshing and confirming. The city of Yahweh. Let Arafat learn that. Let the Palestinians learn that. Let the Arab world learn that. Let the whole world, and the Pope included, learn that. Got nothing to do with their inheritance or what they might think. International agreement as to who's going to run Jerusalem. Who do you think he is? The city of Yahweh, the Zion of the Holy One of Israel. That's who it belongs to, isn't it? Beautiful language. And beautifully confirming of all the things that we know and long to see in the world. Well, it's lovely to now see this in the sense that was read to us tonight, really, by Dan, because we started just two verses earlier. And we did that because we wanted to show what was the relationship. How's this in verse 1 come about? Out of the blue? How is it that God now shines upon the city of Jerusalem? Its light has come. Well, the answer is in verse 20. The Redeemer shall come to Zion, and unto them that turn from transgression in Jacob, as saith Yahweh. What we have, therefore, in chapter 60 is the consequences of that. What is it, my dear brothers, is going to make the difference? You say, well, God will use brute power. Will he? Well, he certainly will use power. But you know, it doesn't really seem right for the living God, with all of his wondrous intelligence, to use brute and unintelligible power. It doesn't just seem right. And it isn't. As for me, this is my covenant, verse 21. With them, saith Yahweh, my spirit that is upon thee, and my words which I have put in thy mouth, shall not depart out of thy mouth. That's true. God is working with his Son. He's working with the Redeemer. He's putting words into his mouth. Those very words are a long echo back to Moses in Deuteronomy chapter 15 and verse 18. Do you remember we looked that up? Did we look it up last week? Perhaps we didn't. Well, quickly, keep your hand there and have a look. Terribly important to see this. It's a long echo back to what God said he would do. In Deuteronomy 18 and verse 18, I will raise them up a prophet from among their brethren like unto thee, and will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak unto them all that I shall command him. It is direct. This is not having a little school of the prophets. This is God's school. He has got a student there that is beyond any other that's ever been on the earth. And in this very unparalleled manner, he says, I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak unto them all that I shall command him. It's beautiful, isn't it? That's special. That's divine, direct instruction. A father to his son as nothing else could ever be. Moses was great in all his house, but this is the son. And he speaks to him in a way that is true for no other. And so in Isaiah chapter 59, God is saying in verse 21, my spirit that is upon thee, my words which I have put in thy mouth. Do you remember that earlier, not so much earlier, he said the same thing in chapter 51 and verse 16. We've really picked up this little theme, haven't we, and been quite thrilled by it, I'm sure, to see that there's a lot of this in these later chapters of Isaiah. This is a great theme. Make a note of that in your book. It's a great theme of the latter chapters of Isaiah. 51 and verse 16. I have put my words in thy mouth. I covered thee in the shadow of mine hand. Can you tell me another one? Come on, some of you have got good memories. Sorry? Thank you. I love that. Yes. Exactly. Exactly the same two things. Yeah, can I just have that on ice for a moment? 49 and verse 2. He hath made my mouth like a sharp sword. In the shadow of his hand hath he hid me. Made me a polished shaft. In his quiver hath he hid me. Made my mouth like a sharp sword. And protection. That's exactly what you had in 51 and verse 16. Put my words in thy mouth, and I have covered thee in the shadow of my head. But lovely. God would succor him. Up there in Nazareth, the spies of the Gentiles, God was there. His presence was with that one. He cared for him. Would not allow him to be damaged. But he was training him and training him and teaching him. All right, Dan, what was the next one? 50 verse 4? That's right. Well, we know that one so well, don't we? Yeah. Lord God hath given me the tongue of the learned, that I should know how to speak a word in season to him that has learned. Very special passages. And as we have commented before, there's nowhere else where you have such a privileged insight as to how God did what he did with his son. Nowhere else in the Bible. Not in Luke chapter 2, where you might think it would be. He grew in wisdom and stature with God and with man, and favour with God and with man. But here you've got little details. Chapter 50 is very special. How God came to him morning by morning and instructed him, wakened the little child, because he wanted to teach him, because he wanted that child to know what he had to do in life and what was right and what was wrong and what he must stand for and the type of things he must be about in his life and the responsibilities that would come upon him. All that's tremendous for us as parents and grandparents, isn't it? Tremendous stuff for us. Doesn't Ronald Coley this child with a whole lot of 21st century, luxuries and expect he's going to get something out of that. He trained that child by personal instruction. And that's the only way it will be done. Got a child, got a son, got a daughter, take it to heart. That's how it's done. Every day. Constant. You don't say, well, the world's changed today, so my child be different today from what others were. It's not the way it happens at all. What we say is that's what we want, and that's what God will bless us with if we work for it. That's what we do. And never mind how much change is going out in the world and rapidly preparing for Armageddon, we got our course set. We know where we're going with it. Now take that to heart, because that's how God did it with his son. He didn't say, well, look, Israel's a bit different today. Look at the Pharisees, Sadducees, bad bunch they are. I'll just fashion him up certain ways so he'll be okay to fit in. Didn't do that at all. The last thing he did, he prepared him the way he should be. When he hit the streets, he was different, and people had to conform with the right if they were going to go with him. Tremendous amount of importance in that. Couldn't stress how much that is important for us to see that clearly and be working in our own daily lives, not just as parents either, but as grandparents as well, to take that in and to strive for it. Well, in 59 and verse 21, it says that those things would outwork my spirit that is upon thee. 59 verse 21. And my words which I have put in thy mouth shall not depart out of thy mouth. They'll go on. Nor out of the mouth of thy seed, nor out of the mouth of thy seed, saith Yahweh, from henceforth even forever. There's going to be a permanent power, an exercise of influence that will come from that. And because of that, verse 1, rise, shine, for thy light has come, and the glory of Yahweh is risen upon thee. And all the beautiful things that you find in the 60th chapter are there because of that. Now, there's another chapter in Isaiah, we've commented on it before, that really speaks, doesn't it, about education and then vast consequences. Bible study in the singular person. Vast consequences. Can you think of what chapter that is? Education of the single person, and the knowledge of the Lord shall fill the earth. Thanks. Good. Saved my bacon. Thanks. Have a look at that. It's a lovely point. I remember Johnny Martin made this years ago, but I thought it was a very beautiful point. In Isaiah chapter 11, the power of Bible study. You know, all sorts of things come up in your day, don't they? All sorts of things. What do we spend time with? We've got time in our lunch hour to spend a bit of time in your Bible? Well, nothing else will be more important than that. If I find that hard to practice in everyday life, I know you do too. But there is nothing more important than that. That affects how we think. And everything we do in that day will be affected by that, because we've taken it to heart. And so we're making the beds, we're cleaning the kitchen, we're preparing the meals, we're preparing whatever we're doing at home or at work. It's being affected by that. Or not affected. That's just the issue of the time, isn't it? Now here's a powerful thing, Isaiah 11. Verse 2, you remember that verse so well. The Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him. Up there in Nazareth, a tiny little home, with all those brothers and a sister. The Spirit of Yahweh shall rest upon him. The Spirit of wisdom and understanding. The Spirit of counsel and might. Oh, this is special, isn't it? In despised Nazareth, great things were happening. The Spirit of knowledge and of the fear of Yahweh. And shall make him of quick understanding in the fear of Yahweh. And the consequence? That's one man's personal Bible study. What's the result? Verse 9, they shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of Yahweh as the waters cover the sea. One man's individual Bible study floods the world with its good effects. What a beautiful thing that is. The knowledge of Yahweh. That's what he was given in verse 2. The spirit of knowledge. And that eventually is going to fill the earth. And the earth will be conformed to him. Not him conformed to them. They'll be conformed to him. That's our challenge in life, isn't it? Be not conformed to this world, but be transformed. Because eventually, verse 1 of chapter 60 is going to be true. Zion's going to become the center of light. And you can feel, can't you, the difference between that and chapter 59. Verse 9. They waited for light, verse 9, but behold obscurity. For brightness, but we walk in darkness. Grope for the wall like the blind. Grope as if we had no eyes. We stumble at noonday as in the night. Rise, shine, for thy light's come. Very beautiful contrasts in this lovely section. But another similar passage in chapter 50. Very similar. This answers that in a very particular and adroit way. In chapter 50 and verse 11, behold, all ye that kindle a fire, that compass yourselves about with sparks. Well, if you will, if you go your own way, then walk in the light of your fire and in the sparks that ye have kindled. And the result, you shall lie down in sorrow. So, that's what men provide until they grope in their blindness and have no light. But chapter 60 is Zion's glad morning. And it says, the glory of Yahweh is risen upon thee. What do you think that means in reality? Is that a normal rising of the sun? Is it the sun's light that has flooded the earth that he's speaking about? I don't think it is it? Because that comes every day. This is spoken of specifically as a beam, as a light of divine enlightenment. The glory of Yahweh is risen upon thee. And that will be outlined further as we go through this chapter. There's going to be a very special feature of Jerusalem. Verse 2 then goes on to speak of the contrast that illuminates even in more beautiful way the power of verse 1. For behold, the darkness shall cover the earth, and gross darkness the people. But Yahweh shall arise upon thee, and his glory shall be seen in thee. Well, I suppose that immediately takes us back, doesn't it, to 59 verse 9 and 10 as the obvious quotation. Gross darkness the people. Look at verses 13 to 15 of that previous chapter. In transgressing and lying against Yahweh and departing away from our God, speaking oppression and revolt, conceiving and uttering from the heart words of falsehood. Judgment is turned away backward, justice standeth afar off. For the truth is fallen in the street, and equity cannot enter. For truth faileth. He that departeth from evil maketh himself a prey. I couldn't help feeling all the rumblings round the world over that man, Mr. McVeigh, that has been put to sleep. And you know, people come out to the streets with in their hundreds, in their thousands, and placard and call their president all sorts of things. As though he's a murderer. As though he's a man killing. Killing? Judgment. You see, just fallen in the streets. You know what the law says about murder? No question about what it says. But here a man is given chances for, you know, 15 months. He only slew 168 people. Cold-blooded murder. Deliberate intention. Has not shed a tear about it. Has not shown a slight bit of remorse about it. And you've got these people going through talking how wonderful the man is. One man had a big placard honouring the fact that he was a soldier of the US Army. Good on you, McVeigh, or something like that. Ah, it's unbelievable, isn't it? Unbelievable. Slew 168 people deliberately and has shed not a tear about it. That's our world, my dear friends. It's just unbelievable what people, the folly of their minds. There's a little saying that's becoming more and more frequent in our society which says that the law is a fool. And you can really feel that. The law is being made a fool. A man does that, and of course, how many others were injured and maimed and so forth? Hundreds of them. And all this hullabaloo. Photographs, all the television, thousands of people are there taking all these photos and so on. Great hullabaloo all around the world. And the president of that country is going to Europe, and what they're going to talk to him about is that he should not do that. Kill a man. Kill him, is it? The term is wrong. It's a sentence of judgment. You see, justice and judgment is turned away backwards. And people think they can do anything and find some alibi that allows them to still continue. Well, the world is just in that position. It really doesn't know where it is going. There's just no way out that they can provide. And I suppose if time went on and on and on, we would find that the law of God, the knowledge of the law of God in the general populace will just become less and less and less. What's it going to be when Christ returns? What a phenomenal change is going to come over the world when the true sense of judgment and justice will come from our Lord Jesus Christ. You sort of feel it in things like you take the British election. If you read up about just the feelings of the people, you've got an election. 2/3 of that people do not want to go any further in Europe, and they want to retain their pound. They want to retain Westminster. 2/3. But almost 2/3 of the people vote into power Mr. Blair, who is absolutely bent on taking Britain in the opposite course. Can you work that out? Can you work that out? They talk about, you know, hospital beds and sewerage and drainage and things. The whole country's future is in the balance. It was hardly an election issue. 2/3 of the people don't want to go any further. This man is just bent on doing so, and he gets 2/3 of the majority of the people almost to vote for him. Can you work that out? Crazy world. It really is a most strange and remarkable world. And the knowledge of God and the integrity of the principles of God, of course, are just not in the minds of the people. I remember reading, for example, in World War I, in the British cabinet, there were 5 members of that cabinet. 5. Who believed on a basis of Bible understanding that it was Britain's role and her privilege to get Israel back to the land. How many would you have today? 5 of them. Not Christadelphians. One of them had a Christadelphian driver, Winston Churchill. 5 of them. Different place, wasn't it? Very different place. So, you know, there's very little understanding of this phenomenal thing that's going to happen in the world when God comes back to Jerusalem. As a matter of fact, as I mentioned last time, and you might have thought I was exaggerating, but if ever there was a statement of Zionism, would it be chapter 60 of Isaiah? It's pure Zionism, isn't it? Absolutely pure Zionism. Do you know what the United Nations did? They passed a resolution which said that Zionism was racialism. Is it? It is. Because God has a people. And there's nothing, no chapter that says that more distinctly than Isaiah 60. Not racialism in the sense the world runs on about it. But they run on as though God has not got a people. And he has. As though he didn't choose the seed of Abraham, Jacob, whom he loved. God allowed the races to develop. It's the world again. It's changed all the thinking. Changed the whole concepts. God has got a people that he has sworn to. And the Redeemer shall come to Zion and turn ungodliness from Jacob. Well, it says at the end of that little verse, but Yahweh shall arise upon them. Sorry. Verse 2, but Yahweh shall arise upon thee, and his glory shall be seen upon thee. Yahweh shall arise upon thee. So the light of verse 1 is not just some ordinary sunlight. It's a special divine emission, and it is seen upon Jerusalem. His glory is seen upon them. That expression, Yahweh shall arise upon thee, is a repetition, isn't it? From verse 1. So God really means that. Notice that repetition. He stated it twice. Yahweh shall arise upon thee. Yahweh shall arise upon thee. Stone-riddled poor old Jerusalem today. And yet God says twice, I shall arise upon thee. His glory shall be seen in thee. We turn to the fourth chapter of Isaiah, not to mention other passages that have something similar. But within Isaiah, it's a very beautiful passage. It says in verse 5, and Yahweh will create upon every dwelling place of Mount Zion and upon her assemblies. So there are places of habitation. And places of meeting together in temple. So upon the temple and in the dwelling places, personally, it says, upon her assemblies a cloud and smoke by day, and the shining of a flaming fire by night. For upon all the glory shall be a covering. The word that's used of a nuptial covering. A covering as in a wedding. So God is saying that he's going to wed that place. And his glory is going to be upon all the assemblies and habitations of Jerusalem. His glory shall arise upon them. And his glory shall be seen upon them. And of course, you look at that language, and what did it remind you of? Reminded you surely about their time in the wilderness, when there was the pillar of fire by night and there was the cloud by day. I don't think they were different things. But when night time came, the light that was in the cloud that could then be seen, piercing as it were through the cloud. And there was a very beautiful depiction of Isaiah 4 that I think it was in the Henry Sully's book. I think there's a frontispiece in there that has depicted that. Have you seen it? It's a very beautiful depiction. And it shows this folding cloud and the light of God's presence breaking forth from the cloud. And that's probably very similar to what it will actually be. But it's a very special divine emission. Now, you just stop and think about that a moment. Don't just read the words. Stop and think about it. Here's something to think about tomorrow. Supposing in Canberra, over the House of Parliament, forbid the thought, but never mind, there was such an emission. People could go and they could look at that building, and above it there was just a remarkable brightness coming forth, just shining into all the hillside all around. What effect would that have on the world? What would be the tourist attraction of Australia? Ayers Rock? The Festival Theatre or Festival House? It would be the phenomenon of the world, wouldn't it? That there, inexplicably, as far as man was concerned, was a glory that was holding the attention of the whole world. And from that was emitting a glory, a glow, which would be the talk of all the world. That's what it's going to be like. But it's not going to be Canberra, nor London, nor Washington. It's going to be in Jerusalem, where there's nothing but stones and dust that flies today. Isn't that a terrific story? My dear brothers and sisters, do you and I believe that? Can you see it? It's a terrific thing, isn't it? Because that's really what a true Zionist is, isn't he? He's got that picture in his mind, and all of his life is being determined by that. He's Zion Woods. He can see that, and God's house there, and that's what he's going for. So all the things he's doing in his life are determined because of that picture. That's his principle. A beautiful thing, isn't it? What a beautiful thing that is. So I'm happy to say we are Zionists, in the truest sense of the word. Call it racialism, call it what you like. But the fact is, the Bible speaks of it as the gospel of God. That this is what God is going to do, and that's the centre in which it will be seen. And we spoke about cheering and healing, didn't we, in our hymn tonight, which we sang. Well, in Malachi chapter 4 is the basis for that. It's a very apt quotation. But unto you that fear my name, Malachi 4 verse 2, unto you that fear my name shall the Son of Righteousness arise with healing in his wings, and ye shall go forth and grow up as calves of the stall. Isn't that beautiful? Beautiful language. The Son of Righteousness shall arise with healing in his wings. Whilst that light will be seen in Jerusalem, particularly around that area, yet the effects of that will be a teaching that will go round the world, healing, cheering, and bringing men back. Well, bringing back to home, as we shall see in this chapter tonight, to what life was really supposed to be all about. And so verse 3 is a natural follow-on from verse 1. And the Gentiles shall come to thy light, and kings to the brightness of thy rising. It's like Solomon's days, isn't it? In fact, perhaps a couple of references from Solomon's time. The first of Kings, chapter 4. David became a source of attraction to the Gentiles, and so did Solomon. In the first of Kings, chapter 4, Isaiah says, the Gentiles shall come to thy light, and kings to the brightness of thy rising. Well, they won't just come to see light. They will come to see all that that city stands for. In 1 Kings 4 and verse 34, there came of all people to hear the wisdom of Solomon, from all kings of the earth, which had heard of his wisdom. Isn't that a fantastic statement? There's the tourist attraction. Not coming to see, you know, some beautiful island up on the Gold Coast or something that Australia attracts to, beautiful as it is. But they came to hear the wisdom of Solomon. It just became a worldwide rumour. This incredible man that's in Jerusalem. What's incredible for? Look, he speaks proverbs. He speaks wisdom in judgment. He just knows all about science. He's just an amazing man. And look what he's done as a young man, built this and so on. People came for all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom. Well, that's what's going to happen with Christ. What a wonderful thing. These are wonderful words, aren't they? Nobody would do that today. Not in your life. Couldn't care less. First Kings chapter 10 verse 24. verse 23 perhaps. So King Solomon exceeded all the kings of the earth for riches and for wisdom. And all the earth sought to Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put in his heart. What did they do? They brought a response. They brought every man his present, vessels of silver, and vessels of gold, and garments and armor and spices, horses and mules, a rate year by year. The Gentiles shall come to thy light, and kings to the brightness of thy rising. Attracted by the policies of truth, beautiful royal policies of truth and of mercy. And so they will come in the great numbers with gifts and to do obeisance to the great king that has come to occupy the world. What a beautiful thing this is, my dear brothers. What an enormously wonderful thing that is. You take, you know, there's a great nation in the world today that people speak of as being the single great power. What a shame that was when their president was found with all of that awful behaviour. What an incredibly shame that was. All the people in the world were reading about that. I wonder how many young people's lives and others were affected by that. They heard the president of the United States was up to those sorts of things, here and there and everywhere. Tremendous ramifications all around the world. And the level of morality just drops, doesn't it, like that? And we had in our state a man who was a sodomite. What that must do to the morality of the people. And the parliamentarians can get in Parliament House and speak and abuse each other in ways that hardly be fit for a pigsty. What does that do to the morality and decency of our population? But what about when there's a king whose mind is filled with wisdom, who loves mercy and loves justice and righteousness? What a wonderful thing. And there's no way of getting around it. He controls the world. You can't come up to him and think you'll put it over him. No way. He'll see straight through you. What a glorious thing that is. Righteousness will be in the earth again, and judgment will be seen, and an evil man will be seen for what he is and put out of the way, and men will fear the name of the Lord. That's what we want. We want a return to divine principles, and God has said he will do it. That's the wonderful thing of this. We don't have to feel as though we're isolated, as though we're on the losing side. We're on the winners. The winners are all with us. We are the party that's going to win through, because God has determined it. Now verse 4 sees Zion's response and enjoyment of what is happening. God invites Zion, this metaphorical woman, this figure of the hope of Jerusalem. Lift up thine eyes round about and see. What does she see? All they gather themselves together, they come to thee, thy sons shall come from far, and thy daughters shall be nursed at thy side. Mother Zion is invited to behold this vast company that is gathering towards her and drawing upon her. You know, this is actually a repetition. Do you remember that? Keep your hand there, would you? And have a look at chapter 49. In 49 verse 18... the very same words, mostly, had been found here in 49 and verse 18. And again, this is about Zion as a woman. Zion said, verse 14, for example, Yahweh hath forsaken me, and my Lord hath forgotten me. But then she was invited, verse 18, lift up thine eyes round about, and behold, all these gather themselves together and come to thee. As I live, saith the Lord, thou shalt surely clothe thee with them all, as with an ornament, and bind them on thee as a bride doeth. So here is a vast number of her children that she's invited to see, and in her wonder she looks out and sees this vast number of people coming to her. And she thought she'd lost her family, but here they come in increasing numbers, and she looks absolutely astonished
the multitude of these sons and daughters that are coming to her side. What a beautiful picture that is. It's the same, isn't it? It's chapter 60. Lift up thine eyes round about. Can you remember those words before? Much before? Who else was told to lift up thine eyes? Good. Genesis 13. Is it relevant? Is a passage in Genesis 13 likely to be relevant to this passage? Have a look. In Genesis 13 and verse 14, Yahweh said unto Abraham, after that Lot was separated from him, lift up now thine eyes. Now, I wouldn't make a parallel out of just those same words, but it is strikingly interesting to notice that that what follows is a statement of Abraham being the heir of, because it says, lift up now thine eyes and look from the place where thou art, northward and southward and eastward and westward, for all the land which thou seest, to thee will I give it and to thy seed forever. And if there was a passage which bears out what Paul says in Romans 4 and verse 13, that he was made heir of the world, it's got to be this passage. Because where is the end of the north and where is the end of the south? What, as good as his eyes could see? If, you know, there was a mountain range there, then that's where it cut off. Or if there wasn't a mountain range, he got more land. That's not the point of it, is it? The point of it is all points to the compass. And Jesus picks up these words and he says, they shall come from the east and the west and the north and the south and sit down with Abraham, Isaac and Jacob. So in a sense, Abraham has been given the world. That's what Paul says, Romans 4 verse 13. So it's interesting. Lift up now thine eyes, and you'll see a seed coming from all parts of the compass. That's just interesting. But there's another one. John 4. Thanks, David. In John chapter 4. Now this is well down in my notes, so I'm going to have to try and work backwards. Anyway, see, let's have a look at John 4 while we're here. John 4 verse 35. Say not ye, there are yet 4 months, and then cometh harvest. Behold, I say unto you, lift up your eyes and look on the fields, for they are white already to harvest. Where is he? In Samaria? Who's coming to him? What do you mean, look up and lift up your eyes? What's happening? Are people coming? Verse 29 and 30. Come see a man which told me all things that ever I did. Is not this the Christ? Then they went out of the city and came unto him. Verse 40, so when the Samaritans were come unto him, they besought him. So they were coming, and Jesus saw them coming. And as he saw them, he thought, this is a most wonderful thing. This Samaritan woman's gone into this city of Samaria and told these people about my knowledge of these things that God has given me, and they're coming. And it was a little echo of things to come. When the Gentiles would come, and he lifted up his eyes, he said, look, you disciples, don't be here talking about food and other things. He said, look what's happening. The harvest is ripe. Look, they're coming. His spirit was lifted up by the event. He thought that was thrilling and beautiful as he could sense the tones of Isaiah. That's what it really was. So he paraphrased Isaiah. If you keep your hand in Isaiah 49 and come back to Isaiah 60. We'll just fill that out a little bit more. It says there in verse 4, lift up thine eyes round about and see, all they gather themselves together, they come to thee. Thy sons shall come from far, and thy daughters shall be nursed at thy side. They shall come from far. But they won't all be coming from far, will they? Because in 59 verse 20, there was some already there. So when Christ returned, there had to be some Jews in the land. Dr. Thomas said that, didn't he, in 1848, and he was right. There's a passage that shows that they were there. They would be there. They won't all come from far. They're all off in America and Russia and Australia and other places. Some were in the land. Of course, they have been. But they weren't there 150 years ago. They had to come. So that was interesting, wasn't it? So they were in the land, and they'll be found there by Messiah. But 60 in verse 4 is speaking about a people that have been brought from far. And they're described in verse 4 as sons, Benim, and daughters, Bathim. From the same root word, Bana, which means to bear. So they're Zion's sons and daughters. Now, if you turn over to chapter 49 again, this is quite an important little exercise if you're trying to handle the prophecy and feel comfortable with it. Remember when we did chapter 49, we reasoned as to who these people were. And we found that they were spoken of as, verse 12, behold, these shall come from far, and lo, these from the north and from the west, and these from the land of Sinim. So it's again, it's got this all parts of the compass concept. And verse 21 says, then shalt thou say in thine heart, who hath begotten me for these, seeing I have lost my children? Israel were lost. The natural children were lost. Came almost a lost cause, it would have seemed. Scattered into all nations. And Zion was left desolate, captive, and removing to and fro. And who hath brought up these? Behold, I was left alone. These, where had they been? This is a new family, a lovely new family. Come back to a woman that felt she had lost all of her children. What a terrible thing it would be to lose all of your children. What a woman's dilemma would that be? That she had a large family, she lost them all. But now she looks about and she says, where did all these come from? And you know, because we turned to Revelation 7, didn't we? We'll do it again, just so that's quite clear. Revelation 7. Come quickly so that we can just cover this point, because we did do it before, but I just want to make sure it's all there in your mind. Revelation chapter 7. If you have a look at Revelation 7 verse 16, you'll see it says, they shall hunger no more, neither thirst any more, neither shall the sun light on them, nor any heat, for the Lamb which is in the midst of the throne shall lead them. And that's Isaiah 49 and verse 10, isn't it? Got the red ink on that one, Philip? Right. So we know that he's dealing with this passage. And the these, well, there's actually a question made in verse 13, exactly like Isaiah. One of the elders answered and said unto me, what are these, which are arrayed in white robes, and whence came they? The answer was, verse 14, these are they which came out of great tribulation and have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Saints. They are people in Christ, aren't they? Is that what Isaiah 49 is about then? Well, it must be, because that's how it's being applied in Revelation chapter 7. I would allow that there's a second run of that thought in Isaiah 49, but I think that that consideration that we've just seen in Revelation 7 makes that pretty clear, that that is a calling of the saints. But in chapter 60, where the same language is used, I think it's making it plain that there is two families, two new families. One that is the old family brought back, and the other that is a new family found in all the nations that have been in Christ. Because when you come back to Isaiah chapter 60, you find that in verse 9, for example, the isles shall wait for me and the ships of Tarshish first. Well, the saints aren't going to need ships to get to Zion, are they? Verse 3 makes it clear, the Gentiles shall come to thy light and kings to the brightness of thy rising. And the saints are already part of that effect in the world. So I don't think you can apply Isaiah 60 in its primary sense to those in Christ, the saints. I think you can to the others, to chapter 49. Well, these now, in verse 4, are described as sons that have come from far, and thy daughters shall be nursed at thy side. And I think that means that these children of Abraham, literal children, have now got the spirit of Abraham and Jacob in their hearts. And they're being brought from faraway countries and being nursed as daughters at the side of Jerusalem. So they are, you see, in the sense of Psalm 87, always a good passage to show the spiritual children of Jerusalem. Psalm 87, verse 4, I will make mention of Rahab and Babylon to them that know me. Behold, Philistia and Tyre with Ethiopia, this man was born there. What, men in Rahab in Egypt are born in Jerusalem? Never. How could that be? They would know anything about the place, wouldn't they? What about people in South Australia that love Jerusalem? That's you and I, isn't it? And so with Philistines, when David left Ziklag, he came up, many people from the Philistines came and were with him, the Cherethites and the Pelethites, and those who came with Ittai, the Gittite. They were Philistines, weren't they? But they had the hope of Israel in their mind because they had been inspired by David. And it says that this man was born then of Zion, it shall be said, this and that man was born in her. Even though they weren't natural seed. Verse 6, Yahweh shall count when he writeth up the people that this man was born there. Well, I think those in Isaiah 60 now are true sons and daughters. I think they are in fact the natural seed, but they've come back to the spirit and heart of Abraham, their father. And nothing is too much trouble. Is it distance? Thy sons shall come from far. Is it frailty? Thy daughters shall be nursed at thy side. No problem is too great. If there's a Mephibosheth, he'll come too. It's not going to be dependent on distance or physical abilities. God will bring them because they want to come and he wants them to be there. You know, these are beautiful things, my dear brothers and sisters. I just find them almost, you get yourself when you're thinking about it, that they're too good to be true in a sense. You know what I mean? They're too good to be true almost. You've been longing to see this. You've read it for so long and you just want it to happen, don't you? I remember once reading of Robert Roberts. He was sitting there patting his little pussycat. Remember he used to have a pussycat, and his son said to him, he said, Dad, he said, what do you want? What do you want to happen? And his father said to him, I want Christ to return. That's what he said. I want Christ to return. It's a lovely thing, isn't it? That's what he wanted. He got to the stage in his ecclesial life where he had so many things, I suppose, that worried him from day to day, and he'd borne so much of the heat of that, that all he wanted was that. He wanted God to vindicate himself and to shine forth in Zion, that all the things he believed were confirmed before people's eyes. That's what he wanted. Beautiful thing, wasn't it? Well, that's a real son of Zion, isn't it? A real son of Zion. I want Christ to return. Sometimes these things are almost too good to believe, aren't they? Because the world outside is going so hard in an opposite direction. Well, in verse 5, we have Zion's response. And it's a very beautiful thing. Then thou shalt see. Invited to see, verse 4, well, she will lift up her eyes. This old woman, frayed with all the history of her studded, difficult history, she shall see and flow together. And it really means a little differently to that. It means she will be radiant. She will beam. Can you see that picture, my dear friends? It's not hard to really understand it. Thine heart shall fear and be enlarged. Can you imagine an old and wizened woman? What is she? Some 90 years of age, shall we imagine? And she thinks she's lost her little children. And there she is in all of her solitary loneliness, desolate and left. And then suddenly she's invited to see, and she looks down the road, and people are coming to her. They're running. And they're joyous and happy, and they're many, and there's all kinds of age groups. And they all envelop her as her sons and her daughters. And it says she just sheerly beams. Of course she would. Of course a woman would. If one boy came back from overseas or wherever it might be and put his arms around his mother, she'd beam, wouldn't she, with radiance. That's what a mother is. Well, what is it when a mother has all these kings? She thought she'd lost them all. Been out in the land of the Gentiles, lost and become foreigners and like the Gentiles. And now they come back. And it says her heart is enlarged. It says, and thine heart shall fear. It's a beautiful expression, wasn't it? In the 29th chapter, there's a kindred expression to that. Shall fear. What do you think that means? Won't her heart be warm toward God? In Isaiah chapter 29, there's a similar picture, if you like. Verse 22. Therefore thus saith Yahweh, who redeemed Abraham, concerning the house of Jacob, Jacob shall now be ashamed, Jacob shall not now be ashamed, neither shall his face now wax pale. But when he seeth his children, the work of mine hand, in the midst of him. Can you see that? Old Jacob. 137 he was when he finished his mortal days. He's going to be resurrected. And he's going to look and see. When he seeth, like Jerusalem sees, the old woman. When he seeth his children, the work of mine hands when he was asleep. In the midst of him, they shall sanctify my name and sanctify the Holy One of Jacob. Jacob! And shall fear the God of Israel. There's a profound respect that has entered into the heart of that man. And that's what's really being spoken of here, isn't it? There's just an overwhelming respect. As when you see perhaps someone in your own life and they do what they said they would do, and they do it, you stand back with a certain measure of awe and you say, oh, that's lovely, this, they really mean that. All the world, we're going to feel that, and Jerusalem's going to feel that when God does what he said he would do. And they'll stand back in enthralled silence at the integrity of God. Because the abundance of the sea shall be converted unto thee. The forces of the Gentiles shall come unto thee. Where it says, the abundance of the sea shall be converted, it really means the same as what the next expression means. The sea was on the west. The forces of the Gentiles shall come unto thee. That is, the wealth of the Gentiles shall come unto thee. So this is all the goodness of the western world that's come to Jerusalem. The forces of the Gentiles. The word is kahil, C-H-A-Y-I-L. Very frequent word. Translated in a whole lot of different ways. But force or wealth or virtue are the words that dominate. So the wealth of the Gentiles and the Western world is going to come to them. But verses 6 and 7 is the acceptance of the Eastern people. West in verse 5, Eastern peoples in verse 6 and 7. It says, the multitude of camels shall cover thee. The dromedaries of Midian and Ephah and all they from Sheba shall come. What are dromedaries? I didn't know what they were either. I thought they were just sort of groups of animals coming together. But a dromedary is a camel with a single hump and a very fast traveller. It's used really for travelling rather than those for bearing loads as those other camels did. So the Rotherham's version and others are translated as the small camels. The multitudes of camels shall cover thee. Now camels were used for trading. They were the beast that brought things from the east through all those long areas of desert, and they still do that even today. You'll have a couple of references there. I won't stop on them, but you'll have a couple of references to them in Judges chapter 6 verse 5 and chapter 8 verse 26. When the Midianites came, they came with huge numbers of camels and dromedaries, those of Midian and Ephah. And they from Sheba, which is in the area of Saudi Arabia, shall come. They shall bring gold and incense, as they were always famed for that incense. Those trading routes have been going there for centuries of time, right back from now, right back until these very early times. And it was the camels that used to allow that trading in those camel caravans, as they were called. In all the times of the Turkish Empire, you'll hear about the caravans. And it was by means of these camels that this trade would be conducted, principally along the coast. It was that Muhammad wanted to take hold of. The Jews, in fact, had control of it at that stage, along the coast of Saudi Arabia. So it's a very old thing that has happened in that region. And then it says in verse 6, and they shall show forth the praises of Yahweh. Now let's get a little picture of that. Here comes these Bedouin-like people, as we would call them today. They bring their gold and incense, the matters in which they trade, and they shall show forth the praises of Yahweh. That's a pretty amazing thing. Here's these old silent Bedouin, these nomadic people of the desert, and they are making their way to Jerusalem. And when they get there, they're not just sitting quietly in the corner and saying, oh yeah, right, what did you say? Oh yeah. These people are evangelists. You see, it says, they shall show forth the praises of Yahweh. These people are alive. They've come from far out places, but they've been struck by the wonder of the things they've heard and the things they see, and their mouths are open. This silent people of the desert, they are showing forth the praises of Yahweh. You know that word show forth, it's the word for evangelizing. In chapter 40 and verse 9, if you've been aware of the comments that Brother Sargent made, it's the word that's taken to the New Testament, where we have the expression, the gospel, the good tidings. Verse 9 in Isaiah 40. O thou that bringest good tidings, that's the expression, that's the verb, get thee up into the high mountains, O Jerusalem. So these people, silent, mysterious folk of bygone days, they now break forth, and their hearts are open and enlarged to express the praises of Yahweh. Isn't that lovely? Couldn't get that out of Arabs too much today, could you? But God's going to melt their hearts when they, even though they see the things that have been done by God. Now, you know, there's a quotation of that in a very unexpected place. It's in Peter, 1 Peter. Speaking to Gentiles who lived in Gentile lands, in 1 Peter 2 and verse 9 he says, but ye are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, all the things that Israel had have come to you, a peculiar people, that ye should show forth the praises of him who hath called you out of darkness into his marvellous light. That's Isaiah 60, isn't it? Twice. The little bit shall show forth the praises is taken from verse 6. And the other little bit, out of darkness into his marvellous light, is verse 1 and 2, isn't it? And there it's being applied to ourselves. Not because it's been fulfilled in its entirety, but because that spirit that will be in the future must now be in our hearts now, mustn't it? If we sort of just can't wait to get home to look at all the things that are in the world, we can hardly be there, can we? We can't be in the kingdom then if that's where our heart is now. God's not going to just switch your heart and say, oh look, I know you really love the football more than anything else then, but now I'm going to make you love the kingdom. He's not going to do that. It just won't happen. We're going to be in that kingdom because now we really wanted to be. We'll be like Robert Roberts. All I want is Christ's return. Because it's in our heart. That's what we want. That's what we're working for. So these people are going to say it then, but we must say it before. Now verse 7 in Isaiah chapter 60 sees another group of people also coming from those eastern Arabian areas. All the flocks of Kedar shall be gathered together unto thee, the rams of Nebaioth, from which comes the Nabataeans. Herod was a Nabataean, wasn't he? And Nebaioth was the firstborn of Ishmael. Kedar and Nebaioth are mentioned in the same verse in Genesis 25 and verse 13. So they're the sons of Ishmael. And the flocks of Kedar shall be gathered together unto thee. The rams of Nebaioth shall minister unto thee. They shall come up with acceptance on mine altar, and I will glorify the house of my glory. They were known for their flocks, but it's really people that are being spoken of here, isn't it? In verse 7. Shall minister unto thee. They shall come up with acceptance. Whilst they might indeed make offerings of their flocks, it's the people that will become acceptable. But what a beautiful thing that is. Here is our flocks that come from faraway countries. And in any earlier times, Israel would have said, well, those animals certainly won't be coming upon the altar in Jerusalem. But now they will, because God has cleansed them. It's a bit like, if you like to make a reference there, to Ezra 6 and verse 9 to 10. Darius said, provide them with offerings when they went back to build that house. And he quoted Cyrus to say that should happen. He said, well, go and do it. And they had to go and do it. The Israelites would say, well, where'd these sheep come from? You know, do we breed these ourselves? Well, they've been given to you for offerings. Well, that's how it's going to be. And God says, they shall come up with acceptance. Divine acceptance. And I will glorify the house of my glory. So there is a house being introduced again into the record of Isaiah. Make a little note there, 56 verse 9 to 10. The house of prayer for all nations. He says, I will glorify the house of my glory. Reminding us of Haggai, chapter 2 and verse 6. And then as a final little note to our evening tonight, look at verse 8. Who are these that fly as a cloud and as the doves to their windows? What windows do the doves go to? To the windows of the dovecotes, don't they? In comes the pigeons, and they zoom in, they come home. What are they called? Homing pigeons. It's beautiful to see them. Round and round and round the suburbs they go, and into their homes, stay on their little windows. What a beautiful thought that is. You can't really send them away. You can put them in a box and you can take them 10 miles down the road, or 20, and you can let them out and over to their windows. That's home, and they know that's home. You can't stop them. The one in Noah's day knew the window, didn't he? Came back to the window. See what that passage is saying? That's where they always should have been. And when they finalise, when they finally come to their wits, you won't be able to stop them. Who are these that fly as a cloud? You have to push a cloud along? When you see the cloud just drifting through the sky, do you have to push it along? Do you have to say, no, look, go this way? It just goes clean and smooth and silently, whisks along the sky. It's going where it wants to go. You don't have to push it. You don't have to give it directions. It knows where it wants to go. And away it goes, cleanly and beautifully. He says, who are these? Like that. Who are these? Isaiah 49 again. Got a little echo there, hasn't it? Who are these? There's a wonder to this. When Israel's going back, my dear brothers and sisters, all those Jews that are sitting up on all the huge buildings of New York, their eyes forever upon all the statistics of business and money and wealth and all the trickery that goes with it. And they've forgotten a lot of it. And they've gone home. And they've come to realise what Jerusalem really meant to them. And once they had opportunity, they could have come from Europe years ago and gone back to the land. They wouldn't. They went off to America because there's a lot of big money there, big business. And all the time they've done that. They came out of Russia in millions. What did they do? The majority of them didn't go to Israel. They went off somewhere else. They wanted the flesh pots of the world. That's what they wanted. They still want that. But not now. They've come to know where home really is. So as pigeons that can't be stopped, they come and settle. What a beautiful thing that is, my dear brothers and sisters, when God turns the hearts of his people, when a Redeemer shall come to Zion and turn ungodliness from Jacob.